I haven't used that in 33 years, maybe less than I can count on one hand. It just sometimes makes good sense. So if somebody's proposing a development and you know it's going to be controversial, just send it to the Planning Commission. Because you are the objective tribunal of jury of their peers, if you will, rather than going through a protracted process and requiring an agency or a landowner to request a hearing. It just makes sense to just vet it as transparent as it as is necessary. And a couple of instances I can remember where it was more expeditious to just go directly to the Planning Commission because the clock, if you will, the timeline to process applications administratively, we have a 21-day notice period. That's after we've written our draft findings with our preliminary decision and provided notice, and we can't shorten that. And once in a while, the timing works where it just makes sense to send it to the Planning Commission. So AWS, complete fairness, developers want to minimize their exposure to the Planning Commission and the conditional use permit review. Very much respect and appreciate that. My personal preference is to keep the language that we've had, and that is one of the two items that I think we didn't come to immediate same terms with AWS on in the process that we've gone through in the last couple of weeks. Dan, do you want to talk about the planning director's authority to defer things to the Planning Commission?
Sure. Just as a general proposition under Oregon law, it's never a procedural error to provide more process. So the only way you can trip up and have a run into legal problems is if you scrimp on the process. So so for example, if you skip the notice and an opportunity for a hearing and then the permit's issued, those things can be appealed years later. And it's a major shock to developers and property owners when their, you know, seven-year-old permit has now been appealed because the county provided way too little process. So I think in this case, what we're talking about is something that we start out as a land use decision. It could be issued, as I mentioned, as a type two, a director's decision that is appealable on up. Otherwise, it would be final. Whenever I use this kind of provision, and I have it in a couple of the codes where I'm city attorney, is when it's going to be a time saver, when you know that there are opponents massing at the door, and it's going to go to a hearing anyway. And so I in those instances, I never do it really without, you know, consultation with the applicant, but it's a time saver because this is going to go up. And it developers, property owners, they want things to go quicker, and that's fine. It's just that, you know, from my perspective as the local government attorney, and also it should be the case for developers, you don't want to miss a required element of process. So I think this provision just is sort of a time saver for majorly controversial projects. And so I don't really have a preference or a recommendation over, you know, at the applicant say so or not. It's just that's how I've used it in other jurisdictions when I know this is going to be a Donnybrook. And so, and we have, and you've got 150 days to make your decision. Cities are under a 120-day deadline. So those local appeals by opponent neighbors, and you have a lot more opponent neighbors in cities than you do in these settings, so it may not be that a big a problem for the county. It can take forever if you've got really dedicated opponents. So you move it along. You start with the hearing at the Planning Commission. That's what the purpose of this provision is for. And I don't really have a preference as to whether it's owner consent or not.
Okay. Thank you. That actually concludes what we have. So if you want to ask us questions or talk about the letters, the letters that were presented tonight, we should probably read into the record. Commissioner Killian and Commissioner Stanley, you did not receive the letters from Madison Ranches or Northeast Oregon Water Association. Is that right?
Correct, I don't have
them. Okay. I will email those to you right now, and also email them to Stephen. I did summarize those, and the Planning Commission here has those, so. And I think we have some folks in the line to read them fully into the record, so. Am I okay not reading those fully, Dan?
Right, as long as they're available to all the decision makers.
Okay, I'm doing that right now. The two who are only on Zoom. Okay. So that ends our staff report.
Okay, so I guess any comments? This is where I can open the public.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a sign sheet.
Yeah.
Let me grab that for you. Oh, was it here? I'll just put it. So, Bob, would you like to speak? I believe, do we still want to do name, address, like we do?
We should, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
If you can name, address, and then we'll go from there.
My name is Bob Levy. My address is Post Office Box 69, Echo, Oregon. I farm in Umatilla County, but also in Wall County. I have a farm in the Willamette, in both Umatilla and Merle County, and specifically one that's right south of Boardman. Takes the fluid water from Port of Merle and has for since must be in the 90s or 80s, or maybe longer. Originally developed by
Arnold Broad.
There you go.
Oh.
Carlson and Broad. Well, we're not the only area in the United States that has this controversy with high nitrates. I mean, if you Google it, you're going to find it in Arizona and Washington and California. And so right now we're kind of under the spotlight, but it's certainly an issue everywhere. If you look in detail at what the problems are, they're the same in those areas as they are here. It kind of spread out between commercial agriculture, affluent disposal, small agricultural farmers, and in some areas, the big culprit is septic tanks that don't work too well. Certainly, if you look at the research, there are septic tank systems that don't work as designed, have about 60 parts per million of nitrogen in the drain field. And so the closer that drain field gets to a domestic well, the bigger problems you've got. But generally speaking, the water that's leaving agriculture is in the 40 parts per million. So we understand that we're part of the problem, but we're trying not to exacerbate the problem by allowing accessory dwelling units. And so we think we have enough for right now until we get the problem solved. There's a lot of activities going on now. You see them in the paper. Many groups involved, lots of money being spent, but we really don't have a solution other than trying to find a clean water source for those people that are in the Guama areas that are close to these high nitrate areas. So we think it's really important that this process be put on hold for a while until we can figure out how we're going to make sure that people get clean drinking water at least for the next several years until we get this problem fixed. I have submitted 4 pages or so from Wendy Kellington, who's done land work use for us in the past, and Tamlin knows that she's well known. I think her, there's no point in me reading her her letter into the record. It's long, but I think it's very, very accurate. So myself, along with other farmers in the area, have submitted several letters asking for a delay in this process. So I'd like to encourage you to do that. And I thank you for the opportunity to say a few words. I drive to Hefner on such a nice day. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
John, do you want to speak?
I'm just mostly here for information.
Okay. Well, next person on this list is Randy Bent. Hello.
Stacy, there will be one or two online.
Okay.
I think J.R. Cook.
Good evening. My name is Randy Bentz. I'm the master planner for the Oregon Military Department. And I work out of Salem, Oregon. And I'm here on in support of the Naval Air Station in Ridgey Islands memo concerning the comprehensive plan and the code amendment. The Oregon Military Department wanted to have its own memo prepared and signed and submitted as part of this, but we weren't able to get it executed in time for the packet to go in. So I'm here to support Tim Peacher's or Captain Hank's memorandum and to just give you a little bit of background, a little bit of amplification on it. So the Oregon Military Department is the institutional side of the National Guard. We handle facilities, real estate, environmental, and several other things. In fact, we do pretty much everything except military personnel and military operations. We leave that up to the Green Suiters. And so we are concerned about things like training areas, training routes, and that sort of thing. And as you know, the National Guard has several training areas and multiple low-level aviation training routes throughout the state, not just here in Morrill County. And so we're concerned about life hazards for our military personnel, particularly air crews and pilots, as they move, as they train across the state. So over the past 20 years or so, the advent of wind turbines and solar farms have caused some concern with our military training areas. And so what we have been doing for the past couple of years is developing notification and planning tools to help local governments help developers to understand the military implications of where they might site a facility, especially one with tall structures like a wind turbine. And so we've actually worked to develop a multi-layered GIS tool through the Oregon Explorer project. And this is available. We can get access to this for you. And it is an aid for developers to look at a particular piece of terrain that they might be interested in siting a renewable energy project. And it will show how close the training routes are, where the training areas are, what the potential hazards are. And so it helps them. And if we have notification that someone is looking to do this kind of development, then we can offer these kinds of resources. There are also DOD grants available to local governments to do this kind of planning and develop notification processes. And I don't have that information specifically with me, but Kim has that information, and she's really would be interested in some offline discussions on how to make that work for you. We've done some initial work with Wasco County, and we're actually pleased with the way it's going so far with their planning commission. So we're looking to do this, especially in the northeastern part of the state where the majority of our military training actually takes place. Let's see if there's anything I missed here. No, I think that about covers it. We appreciate the opportunity to come here, and I just wanted to let you know that we're not looking to preclude any development, but at the same time, a tall windmill obviously has hazards to aviation training. One other thing that you may not consider, but even solar farms with their glare hazard can be a hazard to air crews as well. So we're interested in knowing where these facilities are being sited, and to help with the process if we can. That's all.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, if I might, while you're waiting for the next person, the planning staff's really been in the habit of notifying the Oregon military and Whidbey Island Even when we have pre-application meetings, when we know it's a larger project, even a data center sometimes has glare, and they just submit a comment to the record that says the glare's not a problem, and that's what they've done to date. So that's not codified, but that's the practice. So we're not proposing any change to that process, and maybe after I talk with NAS folks a little bit more, we'll come back with some specific language that makes it more clear.
Okay. Jacob, report.
Yeah. So my name is Jacob Kane. I'm here representing the Port of Morrill. I guess PO Box 200, Portland, Oregon. I don't have a lot to add other than I'm here for information purposes and answer any question you guys might have about our letter we submitted. Just to reiterate, we're not necessarily against any additional processes, but we'd rather engage a little bit more to better understand the problems that we heard or read in the meeting minutes from the last Planning Commission meeting. We read a lot of the problem, but we never understood the problem, so we could respond to it.
That was an opinion of a commissioner. There was no additional. It was just a personal opinion on that. I know what you're talking about on that.
But I think that there probably is some issues out there that people have.
Yeah, may have been, but I just wanted to clarify that portion of the minutes. That is how that was taken. It wasn't okay. A specific thing was not said afterwards.
No, I appreciate that, but at the same time, we would also like to, I mean, there are concerns, right? And we want to hear those and try to find solutions that pinpoint and address those concerns as they relate to the development code, you know? Our opinion is things have worked very well for us for the last 15 years. And can it be cleaner? Probably. What's the right pathway to make it cleaner? I'm not sure. I think that takes quite a bit of time to develop those, those regulatory devices to make it a cleaner process, to get the planning department more information or whatever process that looks like. But I mean, just to reiterate, you know, we've been very successful, you know, at what we're doing underneath the zones as written. So to make modifications to the process, we just would better understand what the purpose is and what the solution, really what we're trying to pinpoint for the solution. So I guess, you know, our letter was basically we'd like to stretch it out. We'd like to spend some more time really digging into these concerns and pinpoint the solutions. But other than that, if there's any questions, I'm here to answer any questions.
I don't have we're just trying to just make it more clear and more transparent. That is the main purpose of going through and changing all these. That's our goal. Mm-hmm. So does anybody have any questions?
Chair, if I might ask Dan Kearns to mm-hmm. chime in again. And again, we're not changing any of the substantive requirements. Yeah. But by Oregon law, we cannot approve traffic mitigation without providing findings and a public notice. And so as part of that application, that's what this would do. Again, no substantive changes. And unless I do what Dan tells me not to do, we're making it clear. So in the planning process, we might only have, I don't know how many data centers, 6 or 7, and more on the horizon. And each of those, as you can imagine, are at different stages in the process. We've worked with them and really appreciated the one-on-one meetings we've had with not just AWS, but other data center developers. You know, what do you need up front? We have a pre-application meeting. And this just means that every time a new consultant or sub-consultant is brought on, they see the process and they see the standards, as well as members of the public or the neighborhood who might want to understand what process and what standards do you follow. Any other thoughts, Dan?
Sure. I mean, as all of you know, I started working with the county just like 2 years ago, and this was one of the first issues that came on my radar screen, and I was struck by a couple things. Number one, that the process that was being provided, it's kind of over-the-counter permits, weren't consistent with state law procedural requirements, and it exposed the county and the developers to subsequent land use appeals, more than 21 days out, potentially up to 10 years out, which is a shocker for any developer who deals with that. So we needed to make sure that the process that we're following was correct, wasn't overkill, but met the minimum standards of state law. The other thing was it appeared that there are more increasing number of these data centers coming forward, which is a strange creature. And I appreciate the port's engineers' observation that things are working fine. But as these become more frequent with more buildings, longer process, and as these intersections and traffic facilities get closer and closer to failing levels of service, whether it's an LOS measurement or a volume to capacity measurement, they were projected to fail over time. This county is the only permitting agency. As far as I know, the Port of Morrow doesn't administer land use law or any kind of planning, any kind of planning documents or issue permits. And so the port's not really in a position to impose any such conditions that are legally binding, at least none that I have ever encountered. So this is where it has to happen, is at the county permitting level. These conditions have to be kind of ironed out at the front end of these long-term projects. And I don't know that it's been a problem in the past, but as these things proceed on, get more complicated, have more phases, more buildings, more traffic impacts, sooner or later, the situation will come up where there's a failing level of service. And even though there may have been a discussion early on with the port, no developer is going to voluntarily say, sure, I'll shell out several million dollars to fix this ODOT intersection or this county intersection or this segment of Port Road, unless there's a condition or some written agreement that spells out these sorts of details. And that's what this process is designed to do. That's what we've done with AWS on the Gar Swanson project, and that it's supposed to, this process that you're discussing tonight is to just make sure that everyone understands that's how it'll work. And, you know, this is not being forced on the developers here. This reflects their input and how they see the world as well. So, I mean, I think there are some of the lawyers for AWS are on line this evening, and that's my perspective as the county's land use council. It's to protect everyone, understand what the process is, and to make sure there are, you know, binding conditions or a development agreement that ensures mitigation happens when it's needed.
So are we only talking about the impact of traffic, and is that the...
So far, that's been the issue that has required the most exercise on this. You know, some of the others are less difficult to understand, like where is the water coming from, where is the power coming from, and those are really kind of beyond the site plan process, other than, you know, the applicant has to obtain power to the site, has to obtain water to the site, and that's something that's, you know, exactly what quantity and where it comes from, that's a little beyond the site plan process. And so I'm always a little more willing to black box those sorts of site plan issues. The traffic and transportation, though, the facility can open and start operating, and oftentimes traffic does not become a problem until years down the road. Whereas, you know, if they don't have power, they don't even open. They don't have water, they don't start. So that's less of an issue for me. It's transportation is the tricky one.
And I do think, AWS, did you sign up to speak? Oh. Would you be willing to answer questions? Okay.
Sure.
Okay. So
I think we're good.
All right. If
thank
that's
you.
It, I'm good.
Thanks, Jacob. Any more? Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Steve.
Good evening, Chair Ekstrom and members of the commission. My name is Steve Piper. I'm a land use attorney, and I work with AWS and others, but in this instance, AWS on the permitting in the county with your staff on data centers. Address is 1120 Northwest Cooch, Portland, Oregon, 97204. Tamara Landon, well, first of all, I agree with much of what Cameron, Tamara Landon, and Dan, who I've known for years as well, have said tonight about the processes proposed. Tamara and Landon reached out to us 10 days ago or so and pointed out that one of the primary concerns that came, I think, probably from you folks in your work session discussions and then also from staff, is the availability of information at the site plan stage for a data center on how that project will unfold. In other words, where we're going to get power, where we're going to get water, how we're going to deal with industrial wastewater, and to Dan's points, even the traffic issue, where of course we're going to have to get a transportation impact analysis increasingly going forward. So it was presented to us as, we'd like to see if there's a way to amend the code to require more information in the application to address some of those issues. And there's, from our perspective, we're happy and have been, and as you know, we've been happy to work with them on the language. There are limitations on what information, and that's what we talked about really as much as anything, because as Dan just alluded to, we can only go so far. We can identify on site where the infrastructure is going to be proposed, whether it be a new substation, whether it be where the transmission, electrical transmission enters the site, the road access, how we're going to get water, industrial stormwater treatment, and the like. The off-site issues of where that transportation, or I'm sorry, that transmission line, for example, might be extended is literally just that. It's an off-site. We're not the service provider. It's the utilities. Dan laid out the map at the start of your hearing. Those are decisions that we can't make, and we can't predict at the front end exactly how and which alignment or which service is going to come from what direction off-site, but we can provide, as these code amendments do, an assurance that we've got power, water, and other service providers who've agreed to provide service at that site. So the short version is, with those concerns, it was very helpful to hear those concerns. We worked with them on some of the language that better identified what we're able to do and where, again, as Dan just pointed out, we reach a limit on what we can say on the front end when it comes to the off-site service providers, because they're going to have to get their own permits. They're going to have to make the proposal, come to the county, get whatever permits are necessary just to be able to extend service to the site. So that's a long way of saying that, yes, we welcome the outreach, and we were happy to participate. We offered some language that, again, tried to find that line where we can provide more information up to the point where the information is realistic and, frankly, accurate, which we want to make sure what we give staff is accurate on the front end. The checklist is very helpful as an applicant because it tells everybody what we're expected to provide. The addition of 4.166 in particular now as an additional process for the administrative land use decision that will be the review process, hopefully, that works fine. And then finally, I agree with Tamara and Dan about the administrative review process that is required. These are discretionary issues. Staff has to make judgment calls. They have to look for the evidence. These are not numbers in many cases. And as Dan points out correctly, there's a statutory process applicable in every county. And we, the developers, suffer along with the county if we get appealed and it turns out we didn't follow that process. So we're only better served by having a process in your code that we know is going to pass muster if somebody challenges a decision to approve one of our data centers. We don't want to go down the ship with the ship, and we don't want to take it down by not going through the right steps. That's a transparent process, as you know, and we can't really complain about that. So with the land use decision process that is proposed with 166 that Landon pointed out, we're happy to go down that road and provide that additional information. Otherwise, I'll answer any questions to the extent I can.
Anybody have any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Anybody on Zoom?
If I may, JR, we have your letter in the record, you weren't here to sign up. Did you want to provide testimony oral as well?
Before I fall asleep, you bet.
Okay.
I forgot how much I love land use hearings, though. So, if I got into water, it's way easier, right?
Sure.
Chair, members of the Planning Commission, and staff, I J.R. Cook, Director of the Northeast Oregon Water Association. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 1026, Pendleton, Oregon 97801. And I'm not going to get into, I don't think you're asking me to read the letter into the record, so I'll just hit on a couple of high points. I think Tamara hit it off, I think, perfect for this discussion, which is this is a legislative action, which means we have time, and we're requesting right now that we take some time to get through some planning efforts, some data efforts, and really understand both the regional and localized carrying capacity issues of the water quality concerns in these aquifers. So there's all sorts of data out there. There's all sorts of disputes about if this is an ag problem, if this is a land app problem, if this is a localized rural residential problem. We do not have that data to conclude that one land use, approved use, is the problem over another. And in our letter, we reference the fact that most of the Goal 3 protected uses right now are regulated and are doing their part to ratchet back. The municipal and industrial uses are doing their part. The only area that has not really had to look in the mirror, in our opinion, that we need to take a look at and figure out how we help them do their part, but also prevent them from adding or exacerbating the issues, is the rural residential development, the shallow alluvial wells and their proximity to their own septics and their neighbors' septics. A little bit of data I just want to put on the record is the belief is that a septic system is a no net impact. You'd be led to believe that it's a no net impact. Once you flush the toilet, it's treated and doesn't cause any harm. But in reality, a standard septic system actually exceeds the clean drinking water limit of EPA by 6 times. And so it is not a minimal issue in localized aquifers, especially in high density areas. And we just request that we take the time to really understand this and understand the social and economic impacts of allowing additional density, not only in the Lebwama and the critical groundwater areas, but just in high density or higher density rural residential areas in general. It's a carrying capacity issue, and I think if we're going to fix it in one area, let's really take the time to understand it in others so it doesn't come back and bite us in other areas down the road. And that's kind of where we've gone with the water quantity side of things, and we're asking the Planning Commission to work with us, and we're willing to work with you on taking the time to understand and address this a little bit more, in a little bit more detail as we go along. So I'll leave it at that and answer any questions if you have them, but we'd really request that we take some time on this one.
So I wonder, you know, I've seen the different graphs on what the different contributors are to the nitrates in the groundwater, whether it's industry, agriculture, animal feeding, and residential. What would you think the percentage of the contribution to the nitrates in the groundwater would be contributed by any additional of these units that we're considering?
Well, if a standard septic for a single family residence is 60 milligrams per liter for that single family residence, and you're adding another residence, double it. That's just the standard math. I'm not an engineer, I'm not an attorney, I'm just a common sense person trying to fix the problem. But the bigger problem of that is the localized impact. And so if you look at cones of depressions of shallow alluvial wells and where they're grabbing the water from, if your septic system is in close proximity to your neighbor's well, and that cone of depression grabs that water before the clean water out into the aquifer, then you're recycling your own poop water. And I've taught hydromania with the water model now for 15 years, and that's the one thing that our 10-year-olds get most scared about when they see in that water model how close a septic system is to the alluvial wells, right? And so it's not so much the regional or the global issue of water quality, it's the public health and safety of the proximity of that septic system to a neighboring well. And that's the piece that we've really not understood enough to really get a handle on, is are we contributing this in a global fashion, or even if we took industry and ag away, would folks be recycling their own septic water over and over again and never be able to fix their own problem because of proximity and density issues? And that's what we'd like to take a little bit more of a stab at understanding. So
that's kind of my question then. Yeah, what do you think the contribution is if you were to factor it out among all the different people that are associated, how much of it would be coming from residences?
I guess my best answer to that, since I'm not a professional, is I think it's a bigger contributor to the public health and safety issue in these rural residential areas than what you're led to believe by the social influences that we're seeing today.
Also, as part of the LUBGWAMA committee and subcommittee, with NAWA's support and some other support, there was $1 million from the legislature a couple of sessions ago. Some really smart postdocs folks are studying some of those issues about why are the hotspots, and what does the groundwater aquifer look like? What does the hydrogeology look like?
Right.
Why is it this way? And so to summarize, I'd hate to put words in JR's mouth, but I'll try. I think his request and that of Windy River is we don't know how to quantify that right now. And rather than exacerbating the problem, maybe put a pause on it, at least for properties that are in the lower Umatilla Basin. Yeah. Yeah. And what I forgot to mention, and Stephen can pull up a map if we need to, we don't see the nitrate problem in other parts of the county, but all of our rural residential properties outside of an urban growth boundary are concentrated in the north part of the county, outside of Yergin and Boardman. We do have some residential development that we allow outside of the city limits of Heppner, Ione, and Lexington inside the urban growth area. And so Planning Commission may want to consider to allow ADUs in those areas where we don't have any known water problems, but maybe not in the LUBGWAMA. So if you remember the work session, we covered a lot of material. The original language was to allow an ADU, but not if the property's in a critical groundwater area or a GWAMA, a groundwater management area.
And I'm just trying to understand, you know, the dilution and the amount of water that's in the aquifer and what that effect would be.
I'd love to know.
Yeah.
And I heard Clive
that's
Kaiser.
That's what we're all trying to figure out.
Yeah.
Sorry for jumping in, but that's part of the data set that we're
hoping
to secure through. But it's going to take some time, and that's the problem, is that a lot of people don't understand that a peer-reviewed data set and really vetting out some of these things is not going to happen overnight, as we all are seeing. So,
do data centers have septic systems, or are they all hooked to municipalities?
It's a mix of both.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like the one that we were talking about, the coal gen plant would be a septic
on-site
system.
Septic, yeah.
Yeah.
For
the ones partway to Yergin, are they all septic?
Those that are, I don't know for sure. I only know those that we've permitted in the last 3 years.
I think everything that goes on has an effect on this. Everything.
Everything, yeah. For
when
sure.
When we cover up the field that we're putting nitrate water on with the data center, it has an effect. It has to. Where do we draw the line? Okay, this is okay and this is not. I don't know. I mean, that is a commissioner, you know, is it all hooked up to this? Is it all contributing to it? It's the same question you're just answering, different building. I don't know.
Yeah, don't know the answer either.
Camera, Commissioner Killian has her hand raised.
Thank you. Chair Ekstrom.
Thank you. Do you mind if I speak?
I was going to honor
you guys all laugh when I ask. Anyway, I was just curious. Would it be possibly part of the solution having this process go forward with the ADUs, just because they will have to do the testing in those areas, and maybe we would discover the bad wells and maybe also find out more of a concentration area? I mean, it's possible it could be part of the solution and not part of the problem long term.
So was that one of the things you talked about, Tamara, if I understood that right? As part of the conditional use, they would have to show that they have clean drinking water before that would be allowed? Is that right?
That is right. And that data, so two things. I mean, I think Commissioner Killian just offered a proposal that said if I'm understanding correctly, that you support allowing ADUs in the Love Guama with the testing. But the and could that testing be used to better understand the nature of what's going on? I don't know. We've been accumulating a lot of well testing data, and this large EPA grant that the two counties are working on, it's a really large grant. We will probably send the RFP out in January, asking for engineering firms to help with this project. They'll be looking at where the hotspots of these are, and specifically looking at systems other than on-site on-site wells and drinking water systems. So that's a really large challenge. I think we will have very few applications for ADUs, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But we might have some. Whether or not that testing would be useful to better understand the aquifer, I suppose it could have some positive effect on our understanding of the aquifer. But what I've learned in the past several years working on the Love Guama, JR has been exposed to it for 20 or so years. It changes seasonally, it changes on the depth of your well, it can change from year to year. It has changed over time. The average level of nitrates, in a lot of places it's getting better, and in some places it's getting worse. And part of this legislative funding through JR's organizations, through OSU, which is pretty robust, peer-reviewed empirical data, they're trying to understand why those trends are looking the way they're looking. So a few samples from residential homes. I don't think it's going to... I love your optimism. I just don't know that it's going to make a huge difference. But
and it sounds like if you say we got one approved and that he did the testing, it was good, in the next year, it could go bad.
Sure.
What you're saying, if it's changing.
That's right.
I'm just thinking, in the 10 years, I guess, that I've been on the commission, have we done 10 ADUs permitted?
We don't offer ADUs at all.
I mean, when people ask for a secondary hardship housing, it's kind of how I'm seeing it.
An ADU is part of the, Centerville 766?
To increase density
644. Sorry, not even close. So when the initially the legislature said a county shall allow accessory dwelling units, and several of the counties, including Morrow and New Matilda County, said, wait a minute, there are reasons why you would not want a county to require that, for reasons that we're having this discussion for tonight, for example. So they said a county may. And that's why when we presented to the Planning Commission, in isolated circumstances, it's pretty innocuous, I can imagine. But in other areas, how would, as staff, we say yes to one and not to another? And what if we have that scenario, to Commissioner Seitz's point, they test fine for 2 years and then they don't, and we can't revoke a permit at that point, and you've got an accessory dwelling unit there. We can look at some other, temporary housing under a hardship situation, and maybe we allow an ADU as a hardship. So right now, if there's a medical hardship, I thought maybe you were. If a person on a 4-acre parcel in a rural residential zone says, I need to take care of my mother and has a list of health concerns, we can issue what's called a medical hardship. And those, by the way, all those hardships go to the Planning Commission, not administrative. And we do a couple dozen reviews every year of those. And they need, and then when the hardship goes away, they have to remove the mobile home. And the mobile home, a setup of a mobile home, and expanding the existing septic system and connecting to the existing well is really expensive. So a lot of times people will say, well, can I do it in an RV? And our code doesn't allow that. So maybe that's what you want to take. Maybe that's a message you want to send to staff is, for hardship, we could allow an ADU or an RV in addition to a manufactured home. But only for those, more or less temporary hardship situations. Does that sound...
Yeah, there's a reason why a lot of people, when you go into the state of Idaho from Oregon and you don't like what you see, right? And that's what we don't, at least I don't want to have happen here. You know, you don't want just to have dwellings all over the place.
Does that, and we can go back, I don't know, we're probably not going to do another code update for a little while, but if you're asking, we see your hand, Mary, or Commissioner Killian, we could go back and change the temporary hardship standards to allow either an ADU or an RV in addition to a manufactured home.
I can see the benefit of an ADU in South County where we don't have those, and we have, we've employed studies that say we're underserved for residents. And given the restrictive land use laws in the state of Oregon, it's really hard to make lots, especially in a town like Hebner, where one guy owns 3/4 of the ground around town. He doesn't want to do, he doesn't want to expand the urban growth boundary. And like it's hard to find places for people to live, albeit it's a 900-foot thing, but to some people, it's a place to live. Mm-hmm. And I can see it really being a benefit here in some cases, and I can see how it could be not so good down there and exacerbating the problem.
Right.
But I think everything down there exacerbates that problem. I really do. I just think, you know, there's so much development, so many things going on in that area that you can point your finger at everybody. You know, so everybody's contributing.
Mm-hmm. So is there a way we can move forward with ADU here, but leave the Guam and
outside the critical groundwater? Yeah, I mean,
until further information and study is available.
Yeah, so we would just change the conditional use standard back to the point where it says they're not allowed in the Lub Guama or in a critical groundwater area. I don't remember what page that is, but yeah, we could sure do that.
You would need to add that because we already have the hardship availability there.
We have the hardship, but what we could do is allow an ADU for the medical hardship that we already have, in addition to the mobile homes. Yeah. Okay.
Can I speak for the North County? Because I feel like the South County is getting it, and the North County is being pushed under the table. So we're not stopping any kind of residential growth down here, except for accessory dwelling. And the accessory dwelling on personal property that is already owned by taxpayers, I feel, is being diminished, you know, again. And I'm not ready to let go of that idea. So you're going to have to convince me that we caused the problem to begin with and that this will make it worse, because I don't think that residential is the main issue here. I totally agree that it could exacerbate it, but we don't know. Like you're saying, we don't know. And I feel like housing down here really needs to be addressed. So especially elder housing, elder care, there's none here. And there's many reasons why we need to address this issue. And maybe we need to increase the lot size. I don't know, something like that. But I don't think we should just get rid of it in North County.
Chair?
Yes.
If we don't have a consensus on items, maybe what the Planning Commission wants to do is break a few of things apart and take a vote and a recommendation. So that memo that we summarized at the very outset, maybe we, since we're talking about ADUs, want to take
Have we gone by public comment, I guess?
I think so. Did you get, I think we got all the public comment.